So confirmation class brought up for me a memory that we were asked to share, a mistake that we had made, something that we would be comfortable sharing. And so last week in confirmation class, I had to share a story about Lori Shaw. And I think I'm going to go to my grave feeling remorse over Lori Shaw. I can't tell you the names of most of the people I went to elementary school with, and I haven't seen Lori Shaw since fourth or fifth grade. But I will always regret being mean to Lori Shaw. Lori was always bragging about how rich she was. She was always bragging about her famous gospel-singing father. I didn't know anything about Southern gospel groups, so it is very possible that she was telling us the truth when she said her dad was famous. We all just got so tired of hearing about it. And there's more. Lori was tall for her age. She was on track to be a very tall person. But at this age, her height made her awkward. She was growing much more quickly than the rest of the class. In my memory, she towered over us in an intimidating way, going on and on about how her dad was on TV. Now, this was back in the day when being on TV was actually a big deal. So one day, I decided to shut her up. Now, I, being rather short, surprise, surprise, I sat near the front of the class. Lori was in the same column of desks, but she was at the back because no one could have seen over her. She had to sit at the back. Now, one day, as Lori was walking to the front of the class to put her paper on the teacher's desk, you know how you had to do when you finished the spelling test, I ever so casually put my foot out into the aisle, and she tripped, and she fell hard. And there was a moment of silence, and then everyone laughed. And for one teeny, tiny, split second, I was so proud of myself. And for like a gazillion, bajillion seconds since, I've wished I could take it back. Now I hope she's forgotten it. I hope she hasn't remembered the short, round kid who tripped her one day. I was doing everyone a favor. I was putting Lori Shaw in her place. Maybe, I thought to myself as I stuck my foot out into the aisle, she will stop yakking about her stupid father. Now maybe I was jealous because she had a famous father. She may have been as wealthy as she claimed to be. But I don't remember ever any of us ever meeting her father or being invited to her house. She said he was always on the road, touring with his gospel group. And it's very possible she was both wealthy and also lonely for a father she never saw. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. Lori Shaw was not my enemy. A little annoying, sometimes a lot annoying, yes. But to say she mistreated her classmates, nah. Can't say that. She wasn't my enemy, yet I treated her as one. This kind of scenario is so often how the concept of enemy plays out for us. These subtle ways that sneak into our lives. People like Lori Shaw aren't enemies with a capital E, but annoyances that seek to undermine our own peace, our own ability to practice love. I tripped Lori because I was tired of her and because I wanted others to like me. Lori Shaw wasn't someone to be friends with, but someone to ostracize. She was a threat to the rest of us because our fathers weren't famous. Our fathers weren't on TV. Most of us didn't even understand what our fathers did all day. He goes to an office? My 9-year-old brain saw Lori Shaw's dad as a threat. Her important dad made mine seem less so. And we know what to do when we are threatened. Fight or flight. And I wasn't leaving. Peter Stinke, in How Your Church Family Works, writes this. At the onset of threat, self-preservation has more relevance for survival than self-awareness. Long before we could ever talk or think, we called on automatic processes for survival. We call on them again and again. Besides, they act faster than the thinking processes. When we are anxious, we act before we think. The automatic pilot joins forces with the house of emotion, and it dominates. In a reptilian regression, our behavior is not mediated through the neocortex. Anxious, we are apt to lose objectivity and civility. We are in a position to be neither responsible nor loving. Reason and love are best served in a time of calm. In periods of intense anxiety, what is most needed is what is most unavailable, the capacity to be imaginative. Threatened, any of us may dispense with our Christian convictions and values. Anxiety is no respecter of belief systems. It is an indiscriminate trigger. Threat is threat. The reptilian brain is not impressed by the sincerity of what we believe to be true. It does what it is designed to do, react instinctively. But here's the catch. As much as God may love reptiles, as much fun as God may have had imagining the eventual appearance of reptiles on this earth, from the Komodo dragon to the red-eared slider, we are not reptiles. We are children of God, designed to be merciful as God is merciful, designed to be forgiving as God is forgiving, designed to be restorers rather than destroyers, designed to be peacemakers rather than warmongers, designed to tear down walls rather than erecting them. Hear these words again. In periods of intense anxiety, what is most needed is what is most unavailable, the capacity to be imaginative. Imaginative is exactly what God has called us to be. In even the most hurtful, most painful situations, God invites us to imagine a way forward. Forgiveness carries within itself the potential of a threefold blessing for ourselves in being set free from the burden of hatred. For God, as we live into the fullness of all God created us to be, and for the other, the enemy, for the hope of their own healing. Loving enemies requires imagination. It requires patience and practice and presence. It does not happen magically, but with great intentionality and prayer. It is also far from passive. Two of the examples that Jesus illustrates, turning the other cheek or offering a shirt in addition to a cloak, these are creative, nonviolent responses. Both are intended to catch the enemy up in their action, to draw their attention to their abusive behavior. In each example, the abuser loses power as the abused claims the power. It would be naive to imagine this a perfect solution, but it is the path to which Jesus calls us. And it is something we can practice in our everyday encounters. Be careful here. If you spit on your enemy as you turn your other cheek to them, your heart is not in it. If you tear the shirt as you take it off or stomp it in the dust before handing it over, your heart is not where it needs to be. This is a reality we must explore. in this moment, if we disguise fight or flight with a so-called love, we are not ready to meet our enemy. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who knows a few things about facing enemies, and his co-author and daughter, Reverend Mafa Tutu, in the book they wrote in 2014, The Book of Forgiveness, they offer us the idea of a prayer before the prayer. I want to be willing to forgive, but I dare not ask for the will to forgive in case you give it to me. And I am not yet ready. I am not yet ready for my heart to soften. I am not yet ready to be vulnerable again. Not yet ready to see that there is humanity in my tormentor's eyes, or that the one who hurt me may also have cried. I am not yet ready for the journey. I am not yet interested in the path. I am at the prayer before the prayer of forgiveness. To forgive an enemy is to be a force of disruption. To forgive an enemy is to break the cycle of violence. As long as we cling to and nourish hatred, violence will continue. When we interrupt the cycle, we allow room for God's creative imagination to flourish. It requires great strength and great courage. But our reptilian responses, those require strength and courage too. We can fight like a snake or flee like a lizard. Those require strength and skill and speed. And maybe there's actually even a third reptilian choice. It could be in that flight category, but withdrawing into our shells, I think that might be a category of its own. Withdrawing into our shells and hoping the threat outside will go away, even when we know it won't. Inaction and silence will not disrupt injustice. Fight, flight, withdrawal, or creative interruption, creative resistance. I remember looking into my mother's eyes one night when I was a young adult. I looked into her eyes of pain and told her that I hated my father. My father had become the enemy. Having interrupted his drunken verbal attack on my mother, I was furious. "I hate him," I said. "Be careful with that word," was all she said into that midnight darkness. I don't know how she was able to stay present, to refuse to fight, to refuse to run. Without even having words to understand alcoholism as a disease, she knew the truth. While it was a breaking point in terms of needing help, it was also a deeply spiritual moment. Be careful with that word. The word enemy in Greek is hated. The hated one. Be careful, my mother was saying. Your father is not the enemy. Alcoholism is. Maybe we better be careful when we start tossing the enemy label around. But when we do use that label, and when we have come through the prayer before the prayer, we might be ready for dialogue. Tutu identifies four steps of the healing discourse of forgiveness between enemies. And it is a discourse. Admitting the wrong and acknowledging the harm. Telling one's story and witnessing the anguish. Asking for forgiveness and granting forgiveness. And finally, renewing or releasing the relationship. We are not reptiles, but God's very own children, made in God's precious image. We can do more than fight or flight or withdraw into a hard shell of protection. Our bones and skin are fragile and our hearts tender, intentionally so. God forgives unconditionally, writes Archbishop Tutu. So can we. The thief on the cross still dies on his cross, but forgiveness will set his spirit free. And what of you and me standing on the ground with our piles of hurts mounting so high? Will we die a thousand deaths before we die, yearning for revenge? Will we die of that thirst? Will the rage that fills us be the stake on which we burn? Will we stumble over every resistance placed in our way and stay stuck in the misery of it all? Or will we take the chance that we might break free by following this path where it leads, past the whys and lies about how it cannot be? Here is our chance. Take this chance. Break free. Desmond and Mafa Tutu. And so, may this be our path. May this be our truth. May this be our freedom. Thanks be to our God of tender heart. Amen.